There can never be good for the bee, which is bad for the hive. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Welcome, everyone, to Palatine Parkcast. I'll be your host, JP McNamara. Thanks for tuning in. On this episode, we'll be talking about recent policy updates, construction in the district, job opportunities, and our main story, talking about honeybees, why they are important, common misconceptions, and how you can help them thrive. Let's get started. Palatine Park District is now requiring masks inside at all of our facilities, regardless of vaccination status. Thank you for your cooperation while we all navigate our community safety together. Palatine Park District is currently hiring part-time jobs at competitive rates. We are looking for athletic referees and scorekeepers, after-school care staff, facility attendants, lifeguards, coaches, and more. If you or someone you know is interested, please visit jobs.palatineparks.org. Palatine Park District is having a monthly photo contest. Submit your photos on any of our social media platforms with the hashtag PalParkPics to enter. If chosen, you will win a prize and your photo will be used as our portrait on social media for the entire month. Palatine Park District recently concluded its turf replacement project at Falcon Park. The original turf was installed in 2010, and after its life cycle, it was decided to install a new synthetic turf that will provide greater longevity, increased safety, and playability. Palatine Park District is also starting a project on September 27th at Birchwood Recreation Facility to replace the main drive into the facility. The project area spans from the drive entrance on Illinois at the north end down to the Birchwood South parking lot. The Birchwood main drive may not be accessible from late September through the beginning of November, and patrons are encouraged to use the detour to Birchwood South parking lot to access the facility. This month, we will look at the honeybee. There is something magnificent about a creature that not only works for themselves, but also works for others and the entire ecosystem around them. If you ever wondered what drives a bee, or how you could get involved with beekeeping and produce your own honey, this is the episode for you. We sat down with Bill Whitney of City Bee Savers in Wheaton and talked about the intricate lives of bees and why they are so important. So let's go outside, stop and smell the flowers, and dip into some honey as we fly into our conversation about honeybees. I'm here with Bill Whitney from the City Bee Savers. Bill, thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Why is it important to maintain and to help the bees?
Oh, wow. That's a huge question.
That okay. Is. We'll start you off with a philosophical question.
Okay. Well, I'll begin with 100 million years ago when flowers were first pollinated by bees and bugs. And flowers all around the world developed with bees. So honeybees and all bees, of which they're are roughly 20,000 bee species that are known of in the world.
Wow.
About 4,000 to 5,000 indigenous to the United States, and 4,000 to 500 live in Illinois. So, bees are integral to our whole growing ecosystem. So with bees, and I'm not talking about just honeybees, I'm talking about all of the bee species, we're intertwined with our daily lives in many different ways.
You mentioned 400 to 500 bee species in Illinois specifically. What What makes those differences between the species? Is it dramatic or is it just subtle changes?
Some are dramatic. The two species in Illinois that you're going to see, one native, which is the bumblebee, and there's multiple types of bumblebees. They live in a colony, just like honeybees. Honeybees are in managed hives, hobbyist and professional alike. But the majority of all bees in Illinois and in the United States and around the world are solitary. Many of them like to live in a community, like a carpenter bee is a good example. People encounter carpenter bees, and they may see a whole group of them thinking that there's a colony, but actually each is an individual, but they like to live in a community. They tend to live in a community. Leafcutter bees, mason bees, everybody's heard of mason bees. You've probably gone to a hardware store and seeing those little tubes that you can buy, like at Ace Hardware, where it's a whole a group of tubes, and those are for the native bees, and each one of those are solitary, but in a sense they're living in a community.
As an individual, what can I do to help save the bees or maintain the bees?
Okay, great question. And there's a lot of things that you as an individual can do depending on what your resources are. Probably the number one is just to understand a little bit more about bees. If you're a homeowner or if you have a garden plot, you can grow native species. There's a movement to get back to growing more indigenous plants, and that's going to be a number one factor. A lot of the problems that you were seeing with bees have to do with their loss of habitat, and so now they've lost a lot of their the plants that they've they're evolved to work with. And that affects their pollen sources, and their pollen sources will affect their overall health. So growing plants that are indigenous to your area. Another would be use less pathogens, I guess, would be less sprays and poisons. And if you do use them, understand what that is going to do to your environment, because there's unintended consequences from using different chemicals. I think it's way too easy to just go grab a can of something and spray it. And I do see that a lot. A lot of what people don't realize, they call me and they say, oh my gosh, we got bees or we got wasps or hornets. And they're really dangerous and we're frightened to death. And I get there and there's 12 cans of wasp spray that they've unloaded all over their environment, and that's more harmful to them than it is to the colony that they never killed.
Right.
Because they wouldn't have called me.
Right. So kind of the Field of Dreams philosophy, if you build it, they will come. Build out a large habitat for them. Native flowers, like you said, in a garden will help bring back the populations.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I moved into my house about 30 years ago, and one of the first things a neighbor said to me, we put in a garden and we started growing milkweed and so on right away. And a neighbor across the street said, hey, I've never seen so many butterflies before until you guys moved in. And it never really occurred to me. We were just kind of growing things, but that is true. Just a few plants will attract, you're right. You build it and they'll come, and you'll become a, on their path, their regular route. Your home will become their pantry.
Oh, that's so interesting. So they develop, kind of a routine where they have pit stops along the way on their journey, and they remember your house, huh?
Oh, yeah. Animals are similar to humans, and humans are similar to animals in the sense that we're habitual. We have habits. You become accustomed to expecting food source once it's erected. And bees in particular, I'm a little more familiar with honeybees, have an absolutely phenomenal sense of smell. Honeybees can smell at the nanoparticle level. And so their ability to smell a source is just phenomenal. I mean, I was telling you earlier, you said, how is your day going? And I had mentioned spilling honey on my driveway. And I had not finished cleaning it up. And there were a couple dozen wasps and honeybees and hornets already on my driveway going after that honey, and they had smelled it somehow and were here lickety split.
Interesting. And they're just attracted to the sugar and the honey, and what and that is just fuel for them, right? That's what I'm understanding.
Yes and no. So it depends on the species, correct? Honeybees, of course, they're all concerned about storing honey for the winter. That's what makes them unique. They don't stop working 365 days a year, 24 hours a day.
Wow.
They are continually working. Wasp and hornets, they are consuming a sugary product for the carbohydrates. They feed their developing larva protein. So that what they do is they go out, they're carnivores. They go out and eat my honeybees. They'll pull the heads off, or other bugs and larvae, and bring them back to their developing larva. The adults cannot eat that protein or use that. So their larva excretes a sugary liquid that the adults eat.
Oh, weird.
Yes, very, very little known fact. You know, that's why they go to your sugary drinks and food and so on. The wasp, not honeybees.
Right.
Honeybees are strictly a pollen nectar gatherer. And a few other things, like they make a glue called propolis that they get from trees and so on.
Tell me about the process of beekeeping in general.
So let me disseminate my 8-week class into a couple of minutes. So I do teach beekeeping in the winter, and I take it from a different standpoint. I look at a full calendar year and how the honeybees are processing the environment at that time of year, and what are they planning for, and how are they addressing the issues that are occurring to them. And so in that vein, let's start in the springtime. Coming out of winter, there's typically a colony that it has about 10,000 bees in it. And the queen had started laying eggs in the middle of February, because they've got to replace some of the dying bees in the winter. And now the whole purpose of the colony is to grow very large, and so they can make use of the nectar flows in midsummer. At this time right now, we're going through a transition period. They've already grown to their zenith. The queens are laying less eggs than no eggs right now. They're raising different bees than they would raise in the summertime. They're raising winter bees. A summer bee lives 40 to 60 days. They don't care about long-lived bees in the summer. They want lots of them. And so they feed them a very diluted serving of a royal jelly, where the bees that they're feeding now get a very dense and nutritious royal jelly, because they've got to have a lot of body fat to make it 5 to 6 months.
Right.
And so we're in a transition period. Their colonies are getting smaller. The bees that they're feeding have to have a better diet, and they need 90 pounds of honey to make it through the winter.
Wow.
Because to keep the queen and the cluster at 94.5 degrees all winter takes a lot of carbohydrates. That's kind of in a synopsis how the year goes.
Right.
So, and then there's one other little thing that happens in there, and that's all bee species want to swarm. That's the survival of the species technique. So what that means is that they want to repopulate the area with their species. And so in mid-summer, late spring, when the colonies have grown to a really good, comfortable size, there's lots of resources coming in, they can be philanthropic at that point and split, just like the cells in our body split. It's called asexual reproduction. A honeybee colony is considered a superorganism. Darwin thought he got the survival of the species wrong when he studied honeybees, because 97% of a colony are female. How are they passing on their traits when they're infertile?
Right.
There's only one fertile bee in the hive, and that's the queen. And she does no work except lay eggs. So it was a little bit vexing for him until he looked at honeybee colony as a superorganism, meaning they have all the characteristics of a mammal. And I could explain that.
Yeah.
And one of those characteristics is being able to reproduce itself as a swarm in asexual reproduction. And so as a beekeeper, you want to be able to manage that swarming instinct or urge in a way that it doesn't impact your apiary. Beekeepers like to say each colony has its own personality, and it's very true. I've got a couple hundred beehives myself, and it's really interesting. Each colony does have its own personality. Some are real gentle. Some are very good at making propolis or wax, or some are a little bit feisty. You know, any number of things. Each colony does have its own personality.
Bee names, worker bees, drones. What are the main differences between those two besides being male and female? What are their roles and responsibilities in the hive?
Another really good question. The males have one job only, and that's to mate with a virgin queen from a different hive. He doesn't want to mate with a virgin queen from his own hive. That would be a sister of his. And the mating process, again, is very unique in the sense that the males all get together from different hives, and they congregate in different trees, and they're called drone congregational areas. And all they do is sit and wait for a virgin queen to fly by and scent the air, and they all go out, roughly 1,000 go out and try to mate with that virgin queen. Like I was saying, 15 to 20 are successful. And so that's what the drones do.
Sure.
There is one other thing that they discovered that drones actually do in the hive. And that is when they're trying to cool the hive down, drones have much larger wings and they become part of the air conditioning system. And they have a really unique air conditioning system. So they did discover that drones do become part of that. So that's it for the drones.
Sure.
The worker bee that does everything, and she's a unfertilized female, but she has many, many capabilities. And any worker bee does have the capability of taking over a role of another bee if the colony needs it.
Huh.
The colony is always in a state of seeking balance, but some colonies will have a greater portion of their population that are stronger in one area or other, another. But I'll give you an example.
Sure.
In a worker bee function, and it evolves. The first 2 weeks, it's generally they're cleaning out cells and cleaning up the hive and maybe feeding some of the older larvae and so on. And then they graduate into more specific tasks like being a jailer bee or a propolis bee or a water bee or a receiver bee or a honey ripening bee or a forager or a wax builder or a queen attendant or a mortuary bee. There's just a myriad number of tasks that have to be done, and they specialize into those tasks. Guard bees, attack bees, and so on.
So interesting. Are the worker bees the only ones with stingers, or is that a misnomer?
All right, worker bees do have stingers, and so does a queen. But really, a better way to ask that are, do drones have stingers? And
sure.
The answer is no, they don't. And drones don't have stingers because a stinger is actually a modified ovipositor. So no bee or wasp or hornet, male, has a stinger.
Interesting.
So they won't sting you. A queen stinger is different than a worker bee stinger.
How so?
And for a very specific reason. A worker bee stinger has three parts to it. Two of them are lanced barbs, and they have, just like fish hooks, they have a whole bunch of fish hook barbs on each lance. And the third part is a channel. Of course, the venom goes down that channel. And so the barbs are attached to a muscle, and that muscle is surrounding the venom sac. So when a honeybee stings you, that venom sac and the stinger apparatus is pulled out of the bee, and it keeps working. Those muscles are contracting, shoving that lance in, and also delivering some more venom in, and it just works its way into the skin. And it's a very neat apparatus. The quicker you get that stinger out, the less venom you're going to have. And pulling it out doesn't squirt more venom in. Getting it out quickly is really the key.
Oh, interesting.
A queen stinger isn't the same. She has a smooth stinger. And the reason for that is she needs to sting repeatedly. And this is why. I may have talked to you earlier about the swarming instinct.
Right.
When the bees are making that decision to swarm, they will force the queen to lay eggs in these special queen cups they make. Typically 12 to 20 queen cups, but I've counted 45 once in a really, really strong hive. And as soon as she lays eggs in those queen cups, they put her on a diet and exercise program because they want her out of the hive, but she's too fat to fly, and they got to thin her up before that she can swarm out. Then the first virgin queen that emerges, she goes to all those other queen cells, drills a hole, and stings that developing virgin queen and kills it. And if two or three come out at the same time, they battle it out, and the strongest one survives. And so she's got to sting multiple times. Hers is more of a weapon for battle, and for the bees, it's more of a suicide bomber.
When a queen lays her eggs, how many of those eggs will potentially be a new queen for a new hive?
So a queen, typically, she's going to lay 1,000 to 1,500 eggs a day.
Sure.
And of those 1,000 to 1,500 eggs, they're all going to be contributing to the either a worker bee or a drone. In the case of laying eggs for a queen, the bees decide that, not the queen. And so when they have made that decision to swarm, they're forcing her to lay eggs in a special cup device that they make, and it's positioned in a different way as well. And it's got to have a lot more royal jelly in it, and it's going to be a much bigger bee.
Interesting.
And so it's a very purposeful act. So they'll force her to lay eggs in there. And it's like I was saying earlier, it's typically 12, 15 to 20 of those queen cells. Now, it could be for a different event than swarming. It could be that she's injured and they realize, well, she's just not up to the task. And so they'll do what's called a supersedure cell. And they will take just a regular worker bee egg that was not intended to be a queen and refashion that cell. And as soon as about 6 hours after that egg hatches, they'll start feeding it as if it were meant to be a queen. And it will become a queen.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's all about the development and how it's nurtured in its development that
correct.
Determines whether it's a queen or not.
Parents should take note of this. No difference between a worker being a queen during when that egg hatches to a larva. That larva is the exact same larva, but its development now, the way it's fed through its larval development, is different. One gets a very nutritious, healthy diet. The other one gets a kind of a watered down portion of that same diet. And so they don't fully develop like a queen. Her ovaries fully develop, her scent glands. There's a number of aspects that she develops into the bee that she's meant to be.
So as a beekeeper, what is your role in this whole process? What are you trying to accomplish to help these bees out?
So the question becomes, am I trying to help these bees out, or am I trying to get these bees to help me out?
Right.
And it's probably a combination of both. I always ask people, why are you becoming a beekeeper and what do you want to get out of it? And I'll usually get three answers to that question. And one answer is, well, we hear that the bees are struggling and we want to become more involved and get a better understanding and be part of that, a solution rather than the problem. And then I'll get another answer as, we make beer, we have chickens, we have a big garden, and it just kind of fits into our lifestyle.
Right.
And the third one is, we really like honey and we want to get honey. And I take note of, who says that. And invariably, at this time of year, I get these calls. So from the people that said, hey, I wanted to get honey, how come my bees didn't really make a lot of honey this year? What could I have done differently? Almost every time that someone had said, hey, I want to figure out how to help the bees and learn how to, take care of them and so on, they'll call me and they say, hey, what do we do with all this honey? And the reason for that is bees make honey. Healthy bees make a lot of honey. I was one of those beekeepers that I started 29 years ago,
Sure.
and I was one of those people that, hey, I make beer. I have a big garden. I now have chickens. I didn't then. And it just kind of fit into my lifestyle, and I just like the idea of having honeybees on my property. I started out just wanting to integrate honeybees into my garden production, and so in that case, I was looking for honey. But it turned into the more I understood honeybees and what makes up a colony and what their motivations are and how they operate. It just became more and more fascinating to me. I mean, it's just absolutely incredible in their decision making and in their process, and so it became more and more fascinating. People had asked me, "Hey, would you help us with our bees?" You can spend a lot of money on tools and equipment and bees to manage your own hives, or you can spend zero and I can show you how to take care of honeybees with zero money. It's a little trickier with zero, but we'll start with just common things you have around the house, and you can do it with zero money. Grab a couple pallets, take the wood apart. You look up instructions on how to make a top bar hive. It's a very natural way to beekeep. Go to Menards, spring sale. They always give away saws. It's a $14 saw, but you can. They have a giveaway. I have a couple of them. So it's a
Nice.
free saw, and I can saw the wood with that. You can usually repurpose the nails that are in that pallet. And a screwdriver. Everyone has a screwdriver in their house. You probably have a tin can, like a can of beans around, and that's all the equipment you need. And so then you need to catch a swarm to get the bees. And you're off and running. The tin can is to make a smoker. Open the top and then poke my screwdriver through the can and then made a fire in it.
And what
And
does the smoker do?
smoker is what we're trying to do is make it less hazardous to go in the beehive. So bees have evolved by forests in forest, and forests inevitably have fires. And so when they smell that smoke, their instinct kicks in and they go, oh, we may have to move our hive. So everyone in the hive fills their nectar stomach, of which they have two stomachs, a digestive stomach and a nectar stomach. They fill their nectar stomach with half their body weight of
Wow.
resources. And so that immediately makes everybody a little bit lethargic.
Right.
And then they communicate in the hive, which is very dark, through with smells, with pheromones, and it covers up that pheromone smell so they can't communicate. And so now no one knows it's their job to sting you, and they're all rather lethargic. And if you go into the hive during the middle of the day, about a third of the colony is out foraging, and so the bees that are actually their job to sting you are not in the hive. And so it becomes a very easy, a lot of times I don't wear any gear or anything. In the middle of the summer at 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the bees are very gentle. Puff a little smoke in there, and I can go in and do what I need to do.
What are the differences between bees and some of the other flying bugs with stingers? You've mentioned wasps and hornets. What are the differences there?
So, honeybees, like I'd mentioned earlier, it's a suicide bombing mission. It's a one and done. Their stinger apparatus and venom sac is pulled out and they die from exposure. But a wasp and hornet, like a honeybee queen, has a smooth stinger. And so occasionally their stinger will come out when they sting, if they're really drilling it in, but typically they can sting you multiple times. And the venom is different.
If you're in your backyard and you see a nest, how can you tell those nests apart from a honeybee to a wasp to a hornet so you know what you're dealing with?
Ah, so now you've gotten into a subject that I encounter every single day. As you alerted to, I have got a company named City Bee Savers, and we do save bees. We save all the bee species. And I always tell people, but wasps and hornets aren't as lucky. And the truth of the matter is, wasps and hornets have a different social structure, and they don't They don't survive a relocation at this time of year. They could early in the spring, but not at this time of year. In the cartoons, you'll see a big gray nest with a hole in the bottom, and they all say that's honeybees. And so I get lots and lots of calls of people saying, we've got a honeybee nest in our tree. And then I ask them, is it gray with a hole in the bottom or gray brown? And they say, yep, just like the we've seen. And I go, and so now that's a bald-faced hornet nest. It's not a bee. And hornets and wasps, a hornet is a wasp, but a type of wasp, but it's they're carnivores. They make no honey. They have a completely different social structure. Their purpose, and they have a purpose, is to keep the bug population in check.
Sure.
And so I tell them they're not bothering you, if it's really high in the tree, there's not really any reason to exterminate them. Some people are still not that comfortable with them, and then we do remove them.
Sure.
So on. The yellow jackets, you'll see them. Hey, we have honeybees in our house or in our backyard in the ground. And we know for a fact they're not yellow jackets. They're honeybees. And, of course, they're yellow jackets. And one way that you can tell is a honeybee has no yellow on them. But a yellow jacket, many of them are the same size as a honeybee, but they're yellow and black, very distinct yellow and black. And that's your first indication that they're not a honeybee. One problem of identifying yellow jackets is they fly very fast and they don't linger at the entrance. They'll fly in and out, and they have a flight pattern too, which is really interesting. At this time of year, it's like 4 to 6 will fly in and then 4 to 6 will fly out. And you can look up in the air about 6 to 8 feet in front of their entrance, and there's a whole group of them waiting to be signaled to come in. And so it's 4 to 6 go in, 4 to 6 come out, 4 to 6 go in. And that really quick flying, it almost looks kind of like amber and brown like a honeybee. But a honeybee has a different flight pattern. They're a little bit clumsy. They're carrying half of their body weight with resources. And so they kind of come in for a bit of a landing. They'll land on the surface and walk in. And you can get a pretty good view of them at that point. Some of the distinctions when people call me and they say, well, they just fly in and out so fast I can't get a picture of them. I go, oh, okay, that's yellow jackets. And,
Can you tell me about the honey production? Not so much on the bee side of actually producing it, but on the human side and how that process works.
Okay. Yeah, that's, again, there's many facets to that. I can tell you about our experience.
Yeah,
we do something that's a little bit counterintuitive, but it's really convenient for us. You never want to extract honey out at the bee yard because you will literally have a million bees on your extractor, and you can encourage robbing at that point, and bees will start robbing each other's hives. But I've developed a way, or I practice a way, where we actually extract honey right at the bee yard. I've got a 10 by 10 foot tent with sides on it. And then we pull all the honey frames out of, we'll go through the bee yard. I have these special boxes that we'll pull a frame out, brush the bees off, put it in a box, close the lid. And we can get 8 frames in a box. And so as soon as we get 16 frames, the person pulling that honey out of the hive will take it over to the tent. And then we usually have 1 or 2 people in the tent. And we have an electric extractor and a generator and a decapping tank. And we get thousands and thousands of bees on the outside of the tent. But the interesting thing is as soon as we get a couple bees, or, you know, we'll get bees on the inside, but as soon as they get just a, you know, their stomachs aren't very big. As soon as they get a little drop of honey, they're trying to get out. So we never have any bees on us.
Sure.
While we're extracting, which is kind of neat. And then we go through the bee yard that way. We cut the wax off of the comb, just the wax capping. Bees put capping on the wax, on the honeycomb, because honey is hygroscopic. It can take moisture out of the air. And it's important because the bees ripen that nectar down. Nectar is 73% water, and they have to ripen it below 19%. And once it's below 19%, typically they get it down to 16, 17%. They put a wax capping on it. And once that whole frame is capped, then we can take that frame out, cut the wax cappings off. We stick it into this extractor. It's a device that, think of a barrel, and it's centrifuge. So we stick them in that barrel in these little slots, and it spins out all the wax. It goes out to the side of the barrel. Mm-hmm. It drips down to the bottom, and we have a spigot at the bottom. And then we just release that valve into a 5-gallon bucket where we'll put a paint strainer. Because there's wax particles and, you know, little this and that. Mm-hmm. We'll strain out any particles, and that's it. That, wow. The whole thing is done. And if that bucket has a spigot, that's where we fill the bottles.
Right.
And there's nothing else needs to be done.
Yeah, no other heating or processing.
So that brings up another topic in heating honey, and that's a very important aspect. Honey in its natural raw form is a very nutritious and healthy product. It has antioxidants in it. It's antibacterial and antiseptic, so you can use it on wounds. And I've had skin nurses buy my raw honey because triple antibiotic becomes an irritant after a few days, where honey won't, and so it helps wounds. But it's got some vitamin B6 and a number of minerals and nutrients in it. That it's a complete food as well. But if you overheat it, it becomes honey syrup and loses all those delicate properties,
right,
as well as its taste. And so honey also has a natural process of crystallizing, raw honey. And so the crystallizing is another way that honey keeps moisture out of it. So once it crystallizes, then it can't take moisture on in from the air. And a lot of times people will say, hey, your honey went bad. And honey doesn't go bad. I mean, if it gets moisture in it, it does, because it'll ferment.
Sure.
But the crystallizing doesn't mean it's bad. You can re-liquefy it, but do it in a gentle manner. Never microwave it ever. Never boil it or heat it up on a stove, but hot tap water in a pan, and take your glass jar of honey and put that in that pan. And in about 20 minutes, it'll re-liquefy. If it's really, really crystallized, it may take a couple of baths, but you want to do it gently, and then it's back to liquid, or just eat it in its crystallized form. It's got a unique texture at that point.
Interesting. One thing about honey that I've heard, there's a conversation morally. Is it okay that we're eating honey from the bees?
The natural answer, of course, from me is going to be yes. Yeah, it's perfectly fine. But I have put a lot of thought into this. You know, like, what am I doing? You know, and am I being responsible? And I think I can answer that with yes. So if we go back to, you know, one of the aspects of being an American citizen, you'll see in our Constitution that we're given the pursuit of happiness.
Sure.
I've discovered in my own personal life, one of the things that makes me happy is being engaged in things that I can excel at. I love working. I love doing things I like solving problems. I like helping people out. You know, I like this job of working with honeybees and so on. And so that gives me a lot of pleasure. It's amazing. I sit down for a half an hour and I'm bored silly. I just can't stand it. You know, that's torture to me. A honeybee is not thinking about, oh, you know, I regret not getting a college education, or, you know, I need to pay my bill. No, they're engaged in things that are in front of them. They're in the now, right now. And so making honey, they're engaged, they're doing their thing. I'm not robbing them of doing their thing.
Sure.
I'm actually setting up an environment so they can continue to do their thing. I never rob all the honey so it's detrimental to the hive.
Right.
I'm always making sure that they can feed their developing larva. They have enough honey storage for the winter, but they're not monitoring their pantry. They're just, oh, we got nectar coming in. We got to ripen it. Let's store it up there. Whoops, that's full. Let's store it up here. And so I'm taking some of their storage away. And as long as it doesn't impede their development or their survival, they're able to pursue happiness.
Very cool. Very neat. How would you suggest someone starting, if they're very interested in beekeeping, how to start that up? And is it something that anybody can do?
So the answer to that is yes, anyone can do it. So it's not difficult to care for bees, but it requires a lot of knowledge and foresight. The biggest mistake the beekeepers make is they do things at the wrong time and they react rather than being proactive. And so understanding what your bees are preparing themselves for and what they're going to be preparing themselves for and why are they behaving the way they are based on what's occurring around them. And so and it's kind of like chess in the sense that there's levels of understanding as a beekeeper. Bees have been doing their thing for 100 million years. So they're going to survive. They're going to do their thing. Why do they need humans? Well, because we've put them in kind of an artificial environment. We've designed a box that meets our needs, not necessarily all of their needs.
Sure.
They would prefer a cavity in a tree that's about 10 to 14 gallons of space that is about 14 feet up in the air. And we prefer them to be in a box that's 20 to 60 gallons of space and crowded together, whereas they would prefer to be a mile and a half, 2.5 miles away from each other. So we've put them in an artificial environment. And because of that, we've created some problems for them. We've created health issues. Bees are very communal. They feed each other in the hive, and hives that live next to each other or within a couple miles of each other are passing viruses back and forth. And so it spreads. If one colony in northern Illinois has, north of Chicago has a disease, it's going to spread like a wildfire with gale force winds all the way through Chicago.
Oh, interesting.
And that's one of the reasons why in Chicagoland, the national average, which is horrible, is about 44% of the colonies do not live an entire year, which is bad. That's really, really bad. Prior to like the 1850s or recorded history of beekeeping, it was 5 to 10% of the colonies didn't live one full year.
Wow.
And in Chicago area, it's up to 80% of the colonies don't live an entire calendar year. And it has to do with a number of factors. One, of course, is proximity of hives, the volume of those hives in proximity, and then the diseases and parasites that are affecting these colonies. And the knowledge of how to manage that. So that's what a beekeeper is needed for.
So if someone was interested in doing beekeeping, would you encourage it? Would you suggest it?
Absolutely, yeah. But I would encourage it with this. Too many times I see people say, oh, I'm really interested. They'll buy a colony. They'll set it in the backyard. And they don't monitor it properly, and that becomes detrimental to all the other beekeepers in the area. That colony is not going to live because it is now exposed to all the other problems that hives are having, and so any number of things could affect your colony and your neighbors. You want to be a responsible beekeeper. If there's stress in a hive, the colony will become stingy. And so you want to manage that stress, and it's very easy to manage. So, again, it gets back to that knowledge base. The more knowledge you have of your bees and the more understanding of what they're doing throughout the season, you can keep things from getting out of control. If you have a desire, it's just like buying a dog. Oh, puppies are really cute. But if you don't walk that dog and, feed it properly and train it properly, it's really not to that dog's advantage for you to own it. And the same thing with honeybees. Plan on immersing yourself into understanding what's going on with her colony. And that takes a lot of reading. That takes getting into a beekeeping club or a group of beekeepers and sharing ideas and resources. And also be careful, because I started out as a hobbyist. I was an animator for 34 years, never intended to be a full-time beekeeper.
Sure.
And I got caught up into this whirlwind of understanding these things. And I woke up one day and I went, oh my gosh, I got a different job. And so it could happen to you. So be careful.
With, let's say you got one colony in your backyard in a box, how many hours are you putting in a week to make sure you're caring for them and properly maintaining them?
It's going to vary in the time of year.
Sure.
You typically don't have to go into a hive, and you don't want to go into a hive just to go into it. You should have a purpose every time you're going in. In the springtime, you're keeping an eye on, are they getting ready to make the swarming decision? Where are they at in that process? And so every 9 days is sufficient. Every week, it's okay, like every weekend. It may take you about an hour, depending on your speed going through a hive and so on, that particular week. But now let's take an event where your queen is killed and you need to introduce a new queen. Well, you may need to go into that hive 3 times that week.
Sure.
Or let's say that it's your bees just don't have enough honey to get through winter. Well, you're going to have to feed those bees. You might have to come back. I don't like to put too much food in for them. And so I don't want to set up a situation where they have more food to defend that they can than they can defend. So I may have to go back every 3 days and look at it. But that's tip up the lid, see if they have feed, pour in whatever they need, and close the lid. It may make 15 minutes to mix up some sugar water. So it's not labor intensive or time intensive. Extracting the honey, I can do, let's see, well, we just did, there were 3 of us, but let's say I did a 60-pound bucket of honey myself, setting up the tent, going to the bee yard, pulling the frames out, cutting the wax off, spinning it out, putting it back into the hive, putting the honey in a bucket, and taking the tent down and coming back home. It's about 3 to 4 hours. Again, it's not real labor intensive, but you should spend a lot of time understanding what it is that you're doing.
Very cool. Well, Bill, we appreciate you coming on and everything that you do. I think it's an important job that you have in this ecosystem that we call life, and I think it's admirable. So thank you for being on the podcast. Thank you for doing what you do, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you. And I also, I'm really encouraged by your interest and the fact that you're willing to do a podcast about bees. I think that's just a great thing that you're offering your audience. And I hope they got something out of this, maybe a better understanding or a way to look at bees and wasps and how to address their own personal issues.
A thank you to Bill Whitney for sharing his immense passion and knowledge of honeybees with us. We would love to hear from you. If you have any specific questions about Palatine Park District, please reach out to us at ppd@palatineparks.org or give us a call at 847-496-6246 and leave a voicemail. We will try to answer all questions we receive on our next episode. Please subscribe to Palatine Parkcast for the latest information on Palatine Park District. Like and rate us on Apple Podcast and share with others in the community that would like to stay connected. Thank you for listening. Talk to you soon.